From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. It's a rite of passage, a challenge, a test. It's
going to be pretty intense.
A group of first-year medical students dressed in scrubs is about to meet their first patients.
There's a bunch of tables and people are crowded around their bodies. I can smell it.
The thing is, the patients in question are no longer living. It's the students' first anatomy lab.
Typical racing heart kind of deal.
Will the students make the cut?
And now we're cutting through the inferior vena cava to actually remove the heart out of the chest cavity. So that's really exciting.
That's coming up on The Pulse. Also, a look at Camden's Silicon Valley tech past and the science of grunting. First, the news from NPR. What you're hearing is part of the soundtrack of Camden's history.
This is like a time machine.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
I'm Tanya English.
I'm Alana Gordon.
I'm Zach Seward.
I'm Elisa Perez-Luna.
I'm Jeanette Woods.
And I'm Mike and Scott. The Pulse steps into operating rooms and follows maps to really understand the latest science and treatments.
You can think of your genome as a piano.
Being blind from birth, I had to actually learn to think like a sighted person.
Really, the most important thing to make this a success is that the primary care providers have to buy into it.
Always maintain hope.
Fear is woven into the daily existence of medicine.
Neutrinos are some of the fundamental
particles. To see that in the arc of a career is...
They literally have to teach them like what a pencil was.
All right, you see the gene gap.
I may get frustrated
and concentrate.
Slow down the rate at which water temperatures are increasing.
On today's show, the science behind grunting, understanding how snakes fly, and an ongoing fight over e-cigarettes. But first, back to that scratchy record and the history of Camden. The Victrola was made here by RCA during a time when Camden was a tech hub, the Silicon Valley of its era. Zach Seward takes a look at Camden's past and investigates whether a new generation of inventions, with a medical focus this time, can bring the struggling city back from the brink.
See, this is the neat thing.
Joe Pane and Jim Hemscott are company men. 61 years of service between them to good old RCA, which put Camden, New Jersey on the map with a heap of national firsts.
Oh, wow. So the first radio show was broadcast out of Camden, right? In 1920?
Yeah.
They did microphones, radar, the first TV set, which debuted in 1939.
No, that's here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sonar was developed here. Sonar was developed here?
Yep.
Really?
Yep.
Wow.
The three of us are looking at a timeline stretched 15 feet or so across a wall of the RCA Heritage Program Museum. Pane and Hemscott run the place. It's a room and a half housed in Rowan University's main library, and it's packed with mementos of RCA's technological preeminence.
All right, we're all wound up.
Hemscott fires up an iconic RCA relic built in Camden by the Victor Talking Machine Company before RCA was even RCA.
This Victrola with the Caruso record is essentially a 105, 106-year time machine.
This is a tremendous contribution, and RCA kept this in Camden.
RCA basically created the middle class in South Jersey.
It all started in 1901 with that famous dog, Nipper, staring into a phonograph. RCA came along in 1919 at the behest of the U.S. government. America needed the radio technology its European counterparts had flaunted during World War I. GE created RCA, and the military gave the new company rights to the nation's radio waves. By 1937, RCA was Camden's top employer, with 13,000 workers, about a tenth of the city's entire population at the time.
So you're saying it was that sort of Silicon Valley kind of culture of its era. Yes.
And it brought in the secretaries, and it brought in the cabinet makers and the machinists and the factory workers. And people would come in to New Jersey because there were so many jobs there.
Hemscott says things really picked up after World War II, with RCA becoming a leading commercial partner of a then-nascent security state. You probably know RCA as an entertainment company, but plenty of kibble was flowing into Nipper's Bowl by way of contracts from the Department of Defense and NASA.
The International Space Station. We still do the communications and tracking system. All of the video and all of the audio and all of the tracking that you see from the International Space Station came from Camden.
But as RCA's fortunes rose, things for its home city began to crumble. The good times peaked in the mid-50s, then the familiar tale of white flight and political corruption set in. The 70s were really bad, and in the 80s, crack hit. RCA was bought by GE in 1986 and basically sold for parts.
It's worth noticing that the timeline ends with the 20th century. Is there a reason for that?
Well... yeah, there's a reason. We kind of lost interest in what's happening after that.
Hemscott quickly points out that some of the engineering spirit of RCA still remains in Camden, though many of its innovations and firsts live on under a different name.
We are in the L3 Communications Systems East Operations Facility. This is where everything we design gets manufactured.
Dave Micah is the president of this division of L3. It's located right under the old RCA Tower in downtown Camden, which was converted into lofts about a decade ago. This is a modern-day factory floor. No Victrolas here.
This is state-of-the-art manufacturing. Absolutely.
Over 700 people work at L3 in Camden. They're hiring, actually, and about half are engineers. L3 is basically continuing the work of the top secret wing of the defunct RCA. Its bread and butter is secure communications.
About 75% of the work we do is very classified, so we can't get into a lot of details of that, but suffice it to say that the things we do here are to provide equipment for the men and women in the armed service who are protecting this country.
Micah says 100% of his division's work is for the Department of Defense, foreign armies, or the intelligence agencies. The day before we met, he was meeting with the NSA, which has worked with RCA since 1960. The stuff L3 can talk about is secure phone terminals used by nearly all DC officials to talk classified information, battlefield sensors used in Iraq and Afghanistan that are buried underground to detect approaching enemies, and the communication systems used on warships.
The stuff we do is many years ahead of what you would find in many cases in commercial industry.
Micah admits his company is not all that well known outside of the military contractor community. A lot of the work can't be advertised. But the hope is that keeping an engineering spirit alive in the poorest city in the nation will help lead to better days.
I'd like to make it the next Silicon Valley. That's a stretch goal.
A little bit.
Yeah, right.
Micah's a company man, too. He started work at RCA in 1984 and climbed the ranks to the top of L3. He's seen things change in Camden, now a city of just 77,000. But Micah and others I spoke with say they're more optimistic than they've ever been about a Camden turnaround, largely because of another high-tech force building up strength.
So we have an emerging scientific community here in Camden. It's really exciting to watch.
That's Steve Treziak of Cooper University Healthcare, and you guessed it, that growing source of momentum is the medical field.
So I think that our emerging scientific community represents opportunity. So over the next 5 years, 10 years, I think others will see that opportunity and gravitate here to test new innovations.
So that's the hope here, is that startups and other private investments sprouts up around these big institutional pillars.
Zach, that sounds like a lot of optimism. What are some actual examples?
Probably the biggest deal is this new partnership between Cooper and MD Anderson out of the University of Texas. MD Anderson has held the top ranking in the country for cancer care for several years now, and getting them to open up an East Coast base of operations here in Camden was a major victory. It's worth mentioning that the chairman of the Cooper Board is the South Jersey political boss, George Norcross, so that type of influence has also helped speed development. The new Cooper / MD Anderson Cancer Center, it opened just a few months ago, and it accounts for a big chunk of that $455 million in construction activity in Camden over the last 3 years.
Wow, that's a lot of money. Who is driving that?
Yeah, it's almost entirely big nonprofit institutions, Classic, Eds, and Meds. So I stopped by the main redevelopment outfit in Camden and got some new numbers that are going to come out in an upcoming report of theirs. And 42% of the jobs in downtown Camden are in healthcare. So that's how big of a player it's becoming.
So I'm wondering, is all of this going to help the city of Camden and the people who live in Camden?
Fair question. There is a lot of positive momentum, and you talk to these people and you can kind of believe in the vision. There's this reorganized police force that's seeing some success in tackling Camden's staggering amount of crime. And those institutional pillars from Rutgers Camden to Rowan, which is now a research university, and that's actually a big deal. They're putting down these major stakes, but those green shoots of private development aren't really there yet. And it's also easy for some of that optimism about Camden's future to be washed away when you take a drive through the neighborhoods. They're pretty bleak. So it does seem like things might be heading in the right direction. It's just going to take time.
Thank you, Zach.
You're welcome, Megan.
And Zach, there is a reason we're playing this Springsteen song right now, and you posted the answer on our website.
There is. Check it out.
WHYY.org/ThePulse. Coming up on The Pulse, a group of first-year medical students is about to meet their silent teachers, and they are really nervous.
Typical racing heart kind of deal.
I've known that I was interested in medicine for a long time, but this was always sort of looming over me. I knew about it.
That's next on The Pulse here on WHYY. Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. How do medical students learn about the body? Right now, I'm looking at a very famous painting that speaks to that question. I'm at the University of Pennsylvania at one of the oldest parts of the medical school. So I'm looking at this painting. There is a woman on the operating table. She's only half covered, which was rather scandalous at the time. And doctors are performing a mastectomy on her. And the amphitheater is filled with medical students craning their necks, eager to get a better view of what is happening. Of course, you've guessed it by now. I'm looking at a replica of the Agnew Clinic, painted by Thomas Eakins in 1893. A lot has changed in the past 100-plus years in terms of medical education, but the thing that does remain the same is that eager look of anticipation on the faces of medical students. The Pulse's Ilana Gordon recently caught up with first-year med students at Rowan School of Osteopathic Medicine in New Jersey for their first-ever anatomy lab.
It's a Friday afternoon, and some 75 bright-eyed first-year med students, most in their early 20s, are about to meet the very first patient of their formal medical training.
I'll be interested to see, like, how emotional I'll be.
Frances Ding doesn't know what kind of doctor she wants to be, but says today marks a turning point.
I think, like, you get into medical school and you're, like, convinced that you want to do it, but until you've had that experience, it's really hard to be, like, 100% sure.
For Megha Mandalewala, a lot of buildup to this day came from family.
Even in India, my uncles, who were doctors in India, said, like, that's, like, the first thing you do, you know, and, like, my parents, when they found out I was going to med school, they're like, oh, when does anatomy lab start? Like, that was the first thing they asked. Because they know that that's how you learn. Like, the body is so fundamental.
She peeked in the lab yesterday just to scope it out and prepare herself.
I'm, like, a little bit nervous, but I mean excited. But at the same time, like, you have to understand, like, it's weird that we get excited about these things, I think. Like, you know, it's a weird emotion to have. Like, most people don't get excited to see, like, a dead body, so to speak.
It's going to be pretty intense.
Samuel Werner, an aspiring primary care doctor, is steps away from entering the lab.
There's an overwhelming presence that there are dozens of vessels which once carried souls within that room. And no matter how we dismantle them, you can't hide what their original purpose was.
All right, so here we go. We're walking into the lab now, so...
Yeah, everyone looks so, like, official and, like...
This is, like, our first time, like, actually wearing scrubs for... not for fun. So this is, like, extra official, like, walking in.
The first thing that hits you in here is the smell. The lab is large and mostly bare, but reeks of embalming chemicals. About a dozen bodies wrapped in cloth and plastic rest on metal tables. The heads and almost everything else are completely covered, except for the chest cavity. Totally exposed, wide open, bleeding shades of bright burgundies and browns. The lab has two sessions. Students in the alternating one had already made the first incisions, peeling back the skin. Werner, Mandalaywala, and Ding break off into different groups, with five students per table. Today's assignment? Removing and examining the heart.
It's very lumpy.
Slimy, too.
Like, in textbooks, you know, everything has a very defined shape. That is not the case at all. Everything, I feel like, kind of is the shape it is to fit in the body. Oh, my God. Okay, they're going to cut the phrenic nerve.
Call it adrenaline, youthful science lab excitement, or future doctor instincts kicking in. Okay. Whatever apprehension Ding and others had going in, gone.
He's cutting the rib right now so we can have more space to actually go into the cavity. Okay, there you go. That's an interesting sound.
The only information students get about their bodies is the age, cause of death, and the sex. That's it. No names. But Rocco Carcia, Rowan's longtime anatomy teacher, says students will get to know them very well.
The way we approach it here, we make the cadaver their first patient. And so everything that goes along with that, the uncertainties, they learn secrets about the cadaver that probably the patient themselves never really realized.
Carcia doesn't lead any part of the class. Instead, he walks around, checking in as students take charge. The point is for them to integrate what they learn here into their clinical development. Werner and others focus on removing the heart without disrupting other important nerves and parts of the body. It's an art.
Right now, we will be exposing the inside of the ventricle.
Does it seem like a healthy heart?
Yeah, I mean, the patient was 107 years old, and the patient is in pretty incredible shape at the moment of death.
Over the next 2 hours, students peel back layers, trying to identify and understand all the different chambers and arteries. I catch one woman gasp as she first lays eyes on the intricate, tree branch-like patterns of the heart muscles. As the 3-hour lab comes to a close, Mandalaywala and others provide, in some ways, the only real care they can to the bodies.
Can we get another paper towel right around here?
Redressing and wrapping them up.
Spraying
them with fluids to preserve them. It's intimate. Then they filter out and debrief.
Finally, it feels like I'm in med school, you know?
Ding says the experience has been validating.
I'm kind of surprised to see how easy I was able to kind of dissociate, like, the task of what I was doing from, like, the person, the patient.
I was literally holding in my hands a human heart. Not only a human heart, but a heart that belonged to a human.
Werner is still processing, thinking about how the experience is changing his view of his own mortality and choices.
I could see reflected in my hands the life that she chose to lead. Once you hold that, how can you not, moving forward, enter into a new life where you won't consciously be thinking about what choices you make will have on the physical reality around you?
After the year-long course comes to a close this spring, the donated bodies are cremated and returned to their families. students will hold a memorial service where they'll read essays, recite poetry to honor those who donated their bodies. But for now, in what was just moments ago a booming room full of life and energy, these bodies rest, wrapped up, waiting till next class to serve as silent teachers for this next generation of doctors. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
The first anatomy lesson is an experience that sticks with people years later.
I remember being completely overwhelmed by the experience.
That's Jennifer McBride.
The student is introduced into an environment where they have to learn a whole new language with the nomenclature of anatomy.
McBride heads the International Anatomy Education Federation, so we wanted to talk to her about how that field is changing. I asked her about the importance of working on an actual body, as opposed to using new technologies such as imaging or perhaps a virtual experience.
There's really no replacement for looking at a cadaver, whether it's dissected, meaning the students dissected it themselves, or prosected, or previously dissected. The three-dimensional tools, other technological advances that are coming out, ultrasound, all of that good stuff is more of an adjunctual piece for the learning than a replacement. There's no replacement for the cadaveric experience.
Why do you say that?
I'll give an example. So we have simulation for a lot of different things, whether we're talking about healthcare or, for example, flying, right? We have flight simulators where pilots learn how to fly and they test some different skills on flying, but they still have to log those hours in their plane. There's no replacement for that actual experience, that unplanned experience that you have in the air. And it's the same thing when you're looking at a cadaver. You can look at a two-dimensional image of human anatomy on a screen, and it's perfect, and things are laid out the way that they're supposed to be with the right orientations and perfect coloring. But when you get into the lab, things are colored a different way, and it's the same thing when you get into the OR setting. They're going to look a different way. They're going to have a slightly different orientation. You need to be able to know what they look like, what they feel like, when you're in that environment to totally understand what the anatomy is and how it works.
Are all medical students still doing this to some extent, or are some schools moving toward images only? Is that even possible?
No. No schools, to my knowledge and to my colleagues' knowledge, as far as our survey data goes, nobody has gotten rid of the cadaver experience. They all use imaging as an adjunctual piece to help emphasize the anatomy that they've learned in class and also in the laboratory environment, but they do not get rid of the cadaver piece.
And where do you see the field going in 10 or 20 years?
I think based on how things have been going just recently, I think we're going to see more inclusion of clinical bits into the anatomy environment, and rightfully so. We have to remember the end goal of this, and the end goal isn't to make clinical anatomists. We're trying to train future physicians and people that obviously have to be lifelong learners, and medicine healthcare is constantly changing, and so we need to include other things in their learning experience besides just an exposure to cadavers.
Jennifer McBride, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. I appreciate the time.
Jennifer McBride is the head of histology at the Cleveland Clinic Lerner School of Medicine. I also asked her if there was a shortage of cadavers, and she said no. There's usually a decent supply for all of the med schools in the country. So that got us wondering, who are the people who decide to donate their bodies to science? Here's one of them who recorded this essay for us.
My name is Megan Curran Rosenblum, and I grew up in Delaware County, Pennsylvania. I lived in Philadelphia until I moved to Los Angeles to take a job as a medical librarian at the University of Southern California, where I do a lot of work with our rare books in the history of medicine. When you do lectures on the history of how medical schools procured bodies for anatomical learning, inevitably someone in the audience is going to ask you about what you want done with your body when you die. And knowing the desperate and sometimes illegal measures that have been taken in the past for medical students to learn anatomy, my answer quickly became clear. As cheesy as it may sound, I am dedicating my life to the education of medical students, and to have my final physical act on earth being toward that same aim, I think there's real poetry in that. Poetry aside, donating one's body to science has a lot of perks. USC will take care of a lot of the logistics and costs that my family would normally be saddled with. All that is, of course, subject to my dying the right way. If I'm killed in a car wreck or have been autopsied, if I'm over 200 pounds, or if I die of an infectious disease, my body won't be accepted by the school. I'm also an organ donor, and if doctors harvest my living organs, then my dead body's no good to the anatomy students. There emerges an interesting hierarchy of who gets first dibs on my corpse. Telling my family about my decision to donate my body to science had an unintended consequence. My grandmother, who I call Mum, is what we refer to in Delco as a pistol, even as she nears her 90th birthday. She is a very traditional and devout Irish Catholic, so I was surprised to find out that, after hearing about my decision, Mum made arrangements to donate her body to Jefferson Hospital in Philadelphia. I really couldn't be prouder of her.
Megan Curran Rosenblum is a medical librarian at the University of Southern California. She also organizes death salons to get people talking about death and dying. Coming up on The Pulse, excessive grunting irritates people working out at gyms, but does the grunt serve an important function?
There is actually an additional 10% increase in force when yelling.
That's next here on The Pulse. Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. Watching tennis these days can really get on your last nerve. And it's not just tennis players, football players, weightlifters, bulky guys in your gym. Everybody's doing it. Is that really necessary? Brian Boitano never grunted while going for the triple axel. Pulse contributor and Drexel medical student Avir Mitra decided to investigate if grunts serve a purpose. He started off at his own gym.
My gym is the Planet Fitness in Fishtown, and if you remember there, you've probably heard the lunk alarm. It's an alarm that goes off if you make too much noise lifting weights. It kind of goes like this. So today I'm with my bro, Julian Miller of West Philadelphia. He's a personal trainer, and we go to the gym together pretty often.
All right, so Julian, as you know, we work out together a lot. Why do we sometimes grunt at the gym?
It's a way to push yourself, to go hard. Like, you know, that sound is... I really don't know. I have no clue why we grunt.
He didn't really seem to know, so I asked around.
You can't handle that much weight. Put it down. Get weight that you can handle, honey.
And I think it's part of a breathing technique. You know, it is what it is, man.
I'm feeling that they're either emotionally constipated or physically, and I can't really figure out which one.
Nobody seemed to really know, so I went to my trusty resource for all questions, YouTube. I found a channel called Bro Science Life. And the video's called There Will Be Grunts.
Your grunt explains who you are. It's your identity in the gym. Grunting equals force.
Well, wait a minute. Does grunting equal force? I mean, could that be true? Well, I looked into it, and it turns out researchers at Drexel University Health Sciences Program recently did an experiment to figure that out. Their study actually won the Biomedical Sciences Award for undergraduates at Drexel Research Day. Yeah. I met up with them to find out more.
My name is Chris Rodolico. I am a first-year doctor of physical therapy student at Drexel University, and I am the main author of this study.
I'm Dr. Sinclair Smith, and I am the chair of the health sciences department here at Drexel University.
I guess like a lot of people involved in exercise physiology research, we were both athletes growing up, and we both played a lot of sports where consciously or subconsciously you yelled whenever you performed a particularly hard activity. So, for example, I was a martial artist growing up. Whenever I punched, kicked, I was always instructed to yell, and it kind of became second nature. Basically, we wanted to know if there was any point to doing that. So we just looked at the research, we took a look around, and we discovered that there's actually shockingly little research looking at that.
So they came up with a simple experiment to find out. They took 30 people and had them squeeze a hand grip. You had to squeeze the grip as hard as you could, and the hand grip would record the force. There were three different ways you could squeeze the hand grip. First, you just squeeze. Second, you squeeze and exhale at the same time. Lastly, and most importantly, you squeeze and make some type of vocalization.
They basically grunted, although some grunted and some scared some people down the hall with how loud they were screaming.
we really left the type of scream up to each individual.
They had the 30 participants do this over and over. They randomized the order each time and allowed for recovery breaks. Then finally, they sat down with the data to figure out which method of squeezing created the most force on average.
So we actually found very cool information. The research already showed that with that forceful exhale, there is an increase in force compared to just the passive squeezing. However, what we found was that there was actually an additional 10% increase in force when yelling. I'm very sorry, Planet Fitness.
Now, do you guys have any idea why this is actually the case?
One of our hypotheses is that yelling may activate the autonomic nervous system, which is the nervous system that controls the fight or flight response, that feeling you get when you become startled or scared, that adrenaline rush that a lot of people speak of, and that may help the muscle contractions be more complete and more forceful.
I had to bring these findings back to the gym. All right, so I'm here at the front desk at Planet Fitness. What's your name?
My name's Omandi. I'm the general manager at Planet Fitness Fishtown.
So there's this research that happened in Philly, actually. These researchers found out that actually when you make grunting sounds and stuff, you're actually able to create more strength. So seeing that they found that, would you consider maybe breaking the lunk alarm? Or?
No, we won't consider breaking the lunk alarm because they have other gyms, you know, for people that want to grunt and make noises like that.
I told Julian.
Yeah, grunting, I'm sure you hear the story of the woman trying to save her baby from underneath the car. Yeah. And I know she was just grunting like crazy, you know, to get the car off of her. Like, ah, saved her life. Grunting saves lives.
For The Pulse, I'm Avir Mitra.
Time now for some science news. Joining us is Carrie Grenz. She is an associate editor with The Scientist. And in that role, she reads through dozens of new research studies every week and picks out a few for us that caught her attention. This week, earthquakes, dolphins, and flying snakes. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Maiken.
Let's start with the earthquakes. What are researchers learning about rumblings in the New Madrid seismic zone?
This is in an area of the Midwest where Missouri, Illinois, Tennessee, Kentucky, and Arkansas all come together, kind of along the Mississippi River. And the largest earthquakes in recent history in the continental U.S. happened in this area about 200 years ago. And seismologists have thought that since that time, we've just been feeling these aftershocks for decades and decades. But a new study now kind of changes that thinking, and it proposes that these little rumblings are actually building seismic activity, increased stress, not aftershocks, which means that the Midwest might be in for a shakeup.
Uh-oh. So any way we can predict when and how badly?
Oh my gosh, that is the multi-billion dollar question there. You know, one news report did say that some analysis from the U.S. Geological Survey predicted that having an earthquake of similar size to those from the early 1800s within the next 50 years is about 7 to 10%. And the chance of having one of a magnitude 6 or larger, magnitude 6 would be smaller than those, in the next 50 years is about 25 to 40%. So it's possible that there could be a big one.
Any chance they could be wrong?
Of course, of course. I mean, seismologists are not very good at predicting when and where earthquakes will happen.
All right, so let's hope for the best there, and let's move on to dolphins. There's a new dolphin.
Right. So a new river dolphin, which is extremely special. There's only a handful of species of dolphins that live in rivers. Most are in open oceans. And for almost 100 years, it was thought that in South America, there were just two species living in freshwater river basins. But a new DNA analysis of dolphins in Brazil shows that there's, in fact, a third species living in a river. And, you know, people had known that these dolphins were in this river, but they just hadn't considered that this was a different species.
What does this dolphin look like?
Well, they're cute, I think, but this dolphin has a very long snout. And one of the unique features of it is that it has a different number of teeth than the other river dolphins.
Finally, Carrie, your last pick for this week is about flying snakes, which scientists have learned about how they fly. But I have to admit, I didn't even know there were flying snakes.
Yeah, it can be kind of a creepy thought, but they don't fly like birds, but they can project themselves, you know, 30 meters. This is about 100 feet, really far. And they kind of squirm through the air in an S-shaped pattern. They can leap from a tree really far. And, you know, as a circular-shaped animal, you don't imagine that they're very aerodynamic, that they can get very much lift when they're flying off of a tree. But in fact, what the animals do is they will flex their ribs and kind of flatten out their body so they're more like a semicircular arched shape. They'll get more flat. And so the researchers, this was kind of neat, they used a 3D printer to print out a model of a snake in this flattened configuration, and they put it in a tank of water to simulate how a snake would fly. And they found that if you tilt the snake at the right angle, you can actually get quite a bit of lift.
But this 3D printer model gave the scientists an idea of how they do it.
Of the aerodynamics of it, yes. But the researchers also said that it didn't completely account for everything that the animals can accomplish, which is really neat to think about, that these animals still can get further loft and distance than what they could model using this 3D printed snake.
Carrie Grenz, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, well, thanks for having me.
Carrie Grenz is an associate editor with The Scientist and a regular contributor to The Pulse. There is a bid in Philadelphia to ban electronic cigarette use indoors and in public spaces. E-cigarettes are battery-powered devices that deliver a jolt of nicotine. Some of them look a bit like a cigarette, but there is no smoke, just vapor. Should people be allowed to vape, as they call this, where they like? One Philly councilman says no. He is hoping the city will follow the example set by New York, Chicago, and the entire state of New Jersey. Tanya English sniffs out the arguments.
The debates can get contentious. At a hearing in December, while some people stood to give speeches, other advocates made their point by puffing on electronic cigarettes.
Some have a mint flavor, some have a cola flavor, some have a coconut flavor. Imagine, you know, taking, you know, all those different smells and putting them in one room.
Karen Blumenfeld leads GASP, Global Advisors on Smoke-Free Policy. She says the council chamber in New York City Hall is large with high ceilings. But that day, the meeting room was stuffy.
Many people present, including myself, were getting headaches. Some people were getting dizzy and nauseous.
Blumenfeld and her group helped push through the country's very first e-cigarette ban. It was in Paramus, New Jersey, way back in 2009. She says since then, there is emerging science and even more health worries about the fumes that get released when vapors light up.
Nicotine can create headaches, so it's no surprise that people who are non-users were becoming sick from this.
Many traditional tobacco cigarette makers have entered the electronic device industry, and Jeff Steyer says that affiliation has created some knee-jerk opposition to vaping.
There is an almost ideological view here.
Steyer is with the National Center for Public Policy Research.
Well, if big tobacco is involved, if it gives people pleasure, if someone's making money off of it, it must be bad.
I have a 12-ounce the hot apple cider.
Gregory Conley started smoking regular cigarettes as a teenager. Then in his early 20s, he tried watermelon-flavored electronic cigarettes. Vaping offered him not just nicotine, but the ability to inhale and mimic his old smoking habit.
And overnight, I was no longer a smoker.
Conley got a law degree, and he's now a professional advocate for the electronic cigarette industry. He lives in New Jersey, where e-cigs are banned in restaurants. But at a cafe in Philadelphia, he's free to light up.
Tell me about your method.
So if you hold your breath for about 5 seconds and then exhale, nothing comes out. Or if you're drinking a hot beverage, if you just pull your coffee up to your mouth and breathe out, it looks like steam.
You're being a little stealthy, right?
You learn that as long as you're not releasing giant clouds of vapor wherever you are, that no one's going to notice. And the few people that do notice, nobody cares.
There are small trace amounts of nicotine in the testing that's been done. There's not enough trace nicotine that it's picked up secondhand by anyone.
That's Jason Cardiff. He's CEO of the California company Cigarex. He says e-cig vapor is harmless. Maybe you'd like to hear that from someone who's not trying to sell you a product. But for now, the federal government is silent. The Food and Drug Administration is considering regulations for electronic cigarettes, but that decision has been delayed for months. Cardiff says in the meantime, cities and states are stepping in with their own opinions and laws.
I'm a firm believer that through time, those laws will be unwound and everybody will come to understand that you can't treat an electronic cigarette like a regular cigarette.
There's also a patchwork of rules on the job. Philadelphia employment attorney Celia Joseph says companies are generally free to set their own policies, but many haven't.
Proactively, I think they should assess for themselves if somebody's vaping in the workplace, is that safe?
Her advice is don't wait for that inevitable moment when a worker comes in complaining about the vapor in the next cubicle over. For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Joel Patterson produced this week's show. Megan Pinto is our executive producer. And we'd really like to hear from you. Email us with your feedback at thepulse@whyy.org. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.